there's an introduction. And where Ackerman talks about how he came about, you know, to value Dongshan's five ranks. You know, if you look at John Wu in the Golden Age of Zen, John Wu explains Dozen's five ranks historically, and he said, "Well, it's a kind of beginners, you know, to kind of explain to beginners who don't seem to get it, you know." And then, but Hawking felt that it was like the greatest thing, you know, to understand. So you have this great spectrum of how various teachers value it. So that's why we're studying Hakuin and not John Wu. Okay. We're studying Hakuin's, how Hakuin understands it. And also because Hakuin is so entertaining. So, so I'm going to start with the beginning and just read it up to where we were. So, yeah, because it's been so long since we did this, and since you can't remember it, it doesn't matter. So, it's very, I think it, I really like the way he, you know, talks. And so, it's hard to know what anybody got from the last class. So, here he says, so Hakuin, you know, was born in 1689, and he died in 1769. So, and he resurrected the Rinzai School in Japan, which was degenerate at the time, had degenerated, and he codified a kind of koan curriculum, studying the koan's collections. And so that was his style, and that style still exists in the Rinzai school, as you know. So he talks about the junior samadhi, and then he talks about the five ranks within it. He says, we do not know by whom the junior samadhi was composed. So we say it was Tozan. But actually, it goes beyond Tozan. Well, Tozan, I think it was Tozan. Because the Hokyo Zamai and the Sandokai, contains the elements that were expanded in the Hokyo Zamai. So we don't know from whom the Junior Samadhi was composed exactly. From Sekito Osho, Yakusan Osho, and Ungon Osho. Do we know who those three people are? Have you ever heard their names before? Yes. It was transmitted from master to master and handed down within the secret room. Never have its teachings been willingly disclosed until now. So, you know, it was very common in the past, in I think in all religious practices, that monks kept the secret teaching. I think the Bible was not allowed to be read by lay people for centuries. The Bible was the property of the monks. And I can't remember when it became public.
Well, in England, it was the dawn of the 17th century.
Yeah, King James Version, probably the popular.
Charles II.
Right.
So, Father of 17 Bastards and Book of Common Prayer.
So, So I think in all religions, there's always been the secret kitchen and the secret room and that kind of thing. And it's the property of the monks. But everything is kind of public, becomes more and more public later on. So we, I don't know if the Hokyo Zamai and the Sandokai have been chanted in by lay people in Japan. I don't know if that, so when Tatsugami was came to Tassahara to do practice, lead our practice series in 1970, when I was Shuso, Peter Schneider kept talking to him a lot, you know, and he said he wanted to know if we could chant these things. And Tatsugami said, okay. And so we chanted them first in Japanese and then little by little translated them. So it was transmitted from master to master and handed down within the sacred room. Never have its teachings been willingly disclosed until now. After it had been transmitted to Tonzan, Osho means priest, he made clear the gradations of the five ranks within it and composed a verse for each rank in order to bring out the main principle of the Dharma. Surely the five ranks is a torch on the midnight road, a ferry boat at the riverside when one has lost one's way. But alas, he says, the Zen gardens of recent times are desolate and barren. So that's like his environment around him at that time, right? Directly pointing to the ultimate, Zen is regarded as nothing but benignedness and foolishness, and that supreme treasure of the Mahayana, the jewel mirror Samadhi's five ranks of the apparent and the real, is considered to be only the old and broken vessel of his antiquated house, meaning the Soto school. So, as you know, in Japan, historically, from before the 13th century, when Dogen was born, each patriarch of the different schools studied only their style. So, and there was not much interaction between the various schools. So no one pays any attention to this anymore, he says. Today's students are like blind people who have thrown away their staffs, calling them useless baggage. Of themselves, they stumble and fall into the mud of heterodox views and cannot get out until death overtakes them. They never know that the five ranks is the ship that carries them across the poisonous sea surrounding the rank of the real, the precious wheel that demolishes the impregnable prison house of the two voids. Okay, so I'm going to put that a little bit. He's quoting the sixth ancestor. The sixth ancestor's poem, which I've often read to you, about fault finding, about transgression called fault finding, and at the end he says something like, and if the people just keep stumbling on and on until death overtakes them without really having realization, and they don't know that the five ranks is the ship, and he talks about the true Dharma is the ship, the big ship that carries you across the chasm between samsara and nirvana. So he says they never know that the five ranks is the ship that carries them across, or the vessel, right, that carries them across the poisonous sea surrounding the rank of the real, the precious wheel that demolishes the impregnable prison house of the two voids. Now, what are the two voids? two voids are the voidness of self and the voidness of dharmas. That's basic Mahayana Buddhism. In other words, even though it seems like there is a self, there isn't one. And even though it seems like dharmas have a reality, an independent reality, they don't. So those are the two voids, the voidness of self and the voidness of dharmas. This is basic Mahayana standpoint. Because in the so-called Hinayana standpoint, although there is no self, the self is not real. The dharmas are real. So that is one standpoint, like the Sarvastivadin school. The standpoint of the Sarvastivadin school, which was based in Kashmir, was this back way back, is that of course no self is basic Buddhism, but they claim that there is dharmas do exist, even though self is void, dharmas are not. In the Mahayana school, dharmas, self is void, dharmas are also void. So this is, you know, this is what he's talking about. So they do not know the important road of progressive practice. They are not versed in the secret meaning within this teaching. Therefore, they sink into the stagnant water of Shravakahood or Pratyeka Buddhahood. They fall into the black pit of withered sprouts and decayed seeds. Even the land of hand of Buddha would find it difficult to save them. So this is his kind of rhetoric. But so you know what Shravakahood and Pratyeka Buddhahood is. Shravaka is like arhat, follower of the Buddha. And Pratyeka Buddha is a hermit, someone who has realization, but they practice as a hermit. So they don't have the Mahayana spirit of coming out of their shell and sacrificing that for the sake of all beings. Okay. So they're always criticized, right? Mahayana Buddhism always criticizing the Shravakas and Pratyeka Buddhas. So then he talks about his own relationship with his teacher, Shoju Rojin. It's a little bit of a tongue twister. That into which I was initiated 40 years ago in the room of Shoju, who he considers the teacher that really gave him the most, I shall now dispense as the almsgiving of Dharma. When I find a superior person who is studying the true and profound teaching and has experienced the great depth, I shall give this secret transmission to him, since it was not designed for people of medium and lesser ability. So take heed and do not treat it lightly. As we know, the great depth is like Dogen expressed it as dropping body and mind. Death of the ego, so to speak. So how vast is the expanse of the sea of the doctrine? How manifold are the gates of the teaching? You see, Dharma gates are boundless, right? That's what he's referring to. Among these, to be sure, are a number of doctrines and orally transmitted secret teachings, yet never have I seen anything to equal the perversion of the five ranks, the carping criticism, the tortuous explanations, the adding of branch to branch, the piling up of entanglement upon entanglement. The truth is that the teachers who are guilty of this do not know for what principle the five ranks was instituted. So by Hakuin's time, the five ranks had become a kind of play toy of the intellectuals. So it no longer had, it kind of lost its vitality of directness. And this is why Dogen was didn't use it directly, although he presented the five ranks in a way that was vital, but without calling it that. And I've read that to you. It's embedded in the Genjo Koan. Or it could be that our patriarchs delivered themselves of these absurdities in order to harass their posterity unnecessarily. For a long time, I wondered about this. Maybe so. But when I came to enter the room of Shoju, the rhinoceros of my previous doubt suddenly fell down dead. Boom. Do not look with suspicion upon the five ranks, saying that it is not the directly transmitted oral teaching of the Tozan line. You should know that it was only after he had completed his investigation of Tozan's verses that Shoju gave his acknowledgement to the five ranks. After I had entered Shoju's room and received the transmission from him, I was quite satisfied. But though I was satisfied, I still regretted that all teachers had not yet clearly explained the meaning of the reciprocal interpenetration of the apparent and the real. They seem to have discarded the words reciprocal interpenetration and paid no attention whatever to them. Thereupon, the rhinoceros of doubt once more raised its head. Now, I have a footnote here I want to read and see if it's worth telling you about. Okay. This footnote is simply the way the five ranks is presented in the Hokyo Zamai. And I will read that because that, just to keep us on track. It's like the six lines of the double split hexagram. The relative and absolute integrate. Piled up, they make three. Like the five flavored herbs. Like the five pronged vajra, wondrously embraced within the real, drumming and singing come up together. So this is like reciprocal interpenetration. Drumming and singing come up together. The relative and absolute penetrate reciprocally. All of you who wish to plumb this deep source must make the investigation by yourself. He says in secret? Maybe, but maybe secret. Secret. You should exert your own effort. You should investigate through your own effort. I would put it that way, with your entire body. My own toil has extended over these 30 years. Do not take this to be an easy task. Even if you should happen to break up the family and scatter the household, do not consider this enough. You know, this is the extreme of saying goodbye and leaving home. That's what it means. Vow to investigate the secret teachings of the five ranks to the end. For the past 8 or 9 years or more, I have been trying to incite all of you who boil your daily gruel over the same fire with me to study this great matter thoroughly. This is like, a hobo. Hobo, bo means Buddha, and ho means Dharma. But ho also means bum. So it's like a Dharma bum. Yeah, literally. I used to see him out there with his campfire. So, For the past 89 years or more, I've been trying to incite all of you to boil your daily gruel over the same fire with me to study this great matter thoroughly, but more often than not, you have taken it to be the doctrine of another house and remained indifferent to it. Only a few among you have attained understanding of it. He's talking to his students, his monks. How deeply this grieves me. Have you never heard? The gates of Dharma are manifold. I vow to enter them all. How much the more should this be true for the main principle of Buddhism and the essential road of Sanzen. Sanzen means different things in different places. Sanzen is like visiting a teacher to present your understanding of the koan. But for Dogen, it actually means Zazen. Sanzen is Zazen for Dogen. So, here's the first teaching. Which is in order to directly experience the four wisdoms, which are actually the four aspects of prajna. They're also called the four prajnas. So sometimes you say, what is prajna? Prajna is expressed as the four wisdoms, which I'll explain again. Sojun Roshi, his teacher, has said, in order to provide a means whereby students might directly experience the four wisdoms, the ancestors, in their compassion and with their skill in devising expedients, first instituted the five ranks. What are the so-called four wisdoms? They are the great perfect mirror wisdom, the universal nature wisdom, the marvelous observing wisdom, and the perfecting of action wisdom. Those are the four wisdoms. Universal nature, it's called sometimes great equality. I usually call it the great equality, wisdom of great equality. And marvelous observing wisdom and the perfecting of action wisdom. I one time gave you a chart that has the correspondence between the four wisdoms, the three bodies, and the five ranks. And it looks like this.
Oh, yeah.
There are four different correspondences. There's the correspondence of the five ranks, the eight levels of consciousness, the four wisdoms, and the three bodies. I don't think it's in the book, but it's a separate new book. He says, followers of the way, he's going to start talking about the first rank. Followers of the way, even though you may have pursued your studies in the threefold learning is discipline, meditation, and Sila, Samadhi, and wisdom, and prajna. Discipline, meditation, and wisdom. Those are the three full learnings of Buddhism, the three baskets, actually. The three Mahayana baskets. Sometimes called precepts, samadhi, and prajna. Sometimes it's called panya, but panya means learning, whereas prajna means wisdom. So Sila, Samadhi, and Prajna the three, the threefold learning basis, the threefold basis for practicing the Dharma. Followers of the way, even though you may have pursued your studies in the threefold learnings continuously through many kalpas, if you have not directly experienced the four wisdoms, you are not permitted to call yourselves true children of Buddha. Well, that's pretty extreme. And of course, Hakuman is an extremist. But he likes to exaggerate, you know, and make a point. So he's making a point. Even though you haven't experienced the four wisdoms, you can still call yourself a child of Buddha if you want to. I give you that permission. And since Hakuman's not dead, why? I can't say anything. So followers of the way, if your investigation is incorrect and complete, at the moment you smash open the dark cave of the eighth or light of consciousness, the precious light of the great mirror, perfect mirror of wisdom, instantly shines forth. But strange to say, the light of the great perfect mirror of wisdom is black like lacquer. This is what is called the rank of the apparent within the real. The apparent within the real means the apparent in the shadow of the real, or hidden within the real. So this is where the black dominates the white. That's the first rank. So if your investigation is incorrect and complete, at the moment you smash open the dark cave of the Alaya consciousness. So here we have to understand that the eight consciousnesses, the eight levels of consciousness. The eighth level of consciousness is the Alaya Vijnana, which is the consciousness which holds all the seeds of memory and has no a particular interest in you, but simply is the seedbed of all of our experience and produces our actions given our habits and given our propensities. Because every time we do something, a seed is planted or a seed is reinforced. So we have these seed beds of reinforced conditioning. And every time we do something, we plant a seed in that seed bed and water a seed that's already there, and we keep doing the same stuff over and over again. So this is called the conditioned consciousness. The consciousness which is based on our conditioning. But actually, there are various theories about, you know, I'm explaining something very simplistically. There are two aspects of Alaya. One is the seeds that come with our birth and the acquired seeds. And so you can understand that there are seeds, you know, we each have propensities for doing things, right? And these are the seeds that are, for one reason or another, maybe, you know, from some, it's explained in various ways, but when you die, so to speak, the Alaya Vijnana and Manas, the self-consciousness, are reinstated in some other consciousness. I mean, in another birth. I don't know if it's so or not, but that's the way it's explained. So that when there's another birth which has the seeds of self and conscious and propensities, it finds another brain. Those seeds are have their own have the ability to, you know, continue. But I think that it's more like genetics. Like genetic, you know, as each person, as we experience our life, we create new genes, which are carried into the next person, right?
Right.
Yeah. So how it all works, nobody knows exactly, but there's also a human generation. Each generation has its, depending on where we are in the world, each generation forms its own genetics that everybody shares. So it's kind of like this shared, we share certain seeds that go with our society. And we just know certain things in our society that people in another society don't share because of our, those are planted in our alaya before we acquire certain seeds. So there's already something to go on. In other words, it's not original sin. It's original something, but it's not original sin. Because there's nothing moral about it, even though Buddhism is moral, immoral, and neutral. Right. Mm-hmm. So, so the Alaya Vijnana is the seedbed of our all of our actions and thoughts and experience. And when we perform an activity, we, depending on the circumstances, we water the seeds that are there, which sprout and cause us to act in the same way, in a similar way. So this is called habit energy and conditioning. So when he says break open, you know, the black, smash open the dark cave of the light of consciousness, he means to break the hold that the seventh consciousness has on the alaya. The seventh consciousness, called manas, and manas is like our sense of separate self, or ego. It's called false consciousness, actually, but it has a function. And the function of the manas is to send messages. Manas is a thinking consciousness. You know, it, when we think about stuff, that's actually manas. It's discriminating consciousness on the basis of ego or self. So and it's, but manas in its function is a messenger between the alaya and the next level of consciousness, which is mano vijnana. Vijnana means, vijnana means consciousness. So, but and the sixth consciousness, level of consciousness, is also a discriminating consciousness, but it's not an ego discriminating consciousness. It also thinks on a certain level. And it discriminates between the various sense or sensory doors. So when you say, "I see that floor," I see the floor. Seeing is registered by the sixth consciousness. Hearing is registered by the six consciousness. Feeling, touching, smelling, all those, the sense doors are not controlled but cognized by the six consciousness, which also is a thinking consciousness, but it's a discriminating consciousness, but it has no idea of self. So this is how we make the distinction between what we see and what we hear. But it's also possible to hear through the nose and to see through the ear. But I'm not going to explain that because I can't. But so these are the alaya consciousness, the manas consciousness, the manovijnana, and the five sense consciousnesses. Altogether, that's eight. Five senses, mind consciousness, self consciousness, and the seedbed, alaya. So, smashing open the alaya means turning around the consciousnesses so that they become wisdom. When the alaya, this is called paravritti, or turning on the basis. When there's something called enlightenment, enlightenment occurs when the five, when the eight consciousnesses are turned around, and they become the four wisdoms. Because when there's enlightenment, the expression of enlightenment is the four wisdoms. The wisdom of the mirror wisdom becomes the alaya, when it's transformed, becomes the great mirror wisdom, which is what he's saying. The mirror has no mind of its own. I'm not saying that right. The mirror doesn't discriminate. In other words, when the mirror sees when something passes across the face of the mirror, the mirror doesn't distort it. So, you know, when we see things, when we look at our world is always distorted. We don't see as it is. Suzuki Roshi, I was always saying, you should see as it is. Practice is to see things as it is. But we don't. We always see things according to our bias.
Right.
Right?
Yeah. But over and over again, you taught us to see both sides. And that's what the mirror does.
Both sides
of whatever is under consideration.
Yes, we should see both sides of whatever is under consideration. But the mirror just sees. In other words, there are no sides for the mirror. The mirror just sees everything as it is, which is very hard because we always see things discriminated. So, in discriminating, we should see both sides. When we discriminate, which we are always doing, we should be able to see two sides, at least, or more. When Dogen talks about seeing, he always presents 10 or 12 sides, and he presents two or three which seem absurd. But he leaves no stone unturned. But the mirror just sees. That's all. So when you hear a sound, there's just this sound. When you hear the bird cheeping, cheep cheep, when the mirror just hears cheep cheep, the sixth consciousness says, that's a bird. But the mirror doesn't say anything. The mirror just hears cheep cheep. And that cheep cheep is not cheep cheep, it's something. It's just this. Mirror just this. Without discrimination. Nancy?
Could it be called reflection rather than mirror?
No. Yes, I see what you're saying. Mirror, reflection. Not in the sense of reflecting back on something. Reflection. Just reflection. So each one of us has some kind of consciousness which reflects things, right? You are reflected in my consciousness. Well, actually, what I see is a reflection. When I look out, I see reflections. When I hear reflections. Does the sound go to the ear, or does the ear go to the sound? The ancestor says, all is incomplete stillness.
There seems to be a problem of talking about the mirror, because you need to talk about, you can't escape dualistic language there, and we should try to escape dualistic language there.
Yeah.
Maybe in the prior consciousness, dualistic language still holds to some extent discrimination.
Well,
but here, if you say the mirror just sees, it's already, the mirror sounds like somebody seeing.
Mm-hmm. Right. So the way to experience that is in Zazen.
Yeah. We're just talking, so I was just trying to imagine there would be a way to speak of this without falling into the mistakes of language.
Mm, yeah. Well,
I don't know.
You know, give a big shout.
Yeah.
Actually,
it's only poetry, but.
Dogen says a sneeze is a big sneeze is an expression of enlightenment, because everything disappears. But a mirror also sees clearly what is dual. And knows this is duality. When the duality crosses the mirror knows this is duality. So, in other words, it's just being unbiased, totally unbiased to see how something really is rather than the way we think it is. So we can say that. And even though it's a secondary, it's an explanation, accepted as an explanation. So then he says, having attained the great perfect mirror wisdom, you now enter the rank of the real within the apparent. So this is the second circle, right? Where the real, the absolute, is hidden within what is apparent. So the light side is obvious, and the dark side is hidden. So it's like the phases of the moon, right? Like the phases of the moon. Now it's full moon, but the dark side is on the other side of the moon, even though you don't see it.
That's the second ray?
Yeah. Sometimes it's reversed. Sometimes it's reversed. You know, you can reverse them better.
Well, that second rank sounds to me, the way I hear that description, it sounds like mundane consciousness.
Well, it's entering a world of duality. So, mundane consciousness, you can say that, yeah. It's the realm of form. So having attained the great perfect mirror of wisdom, in other words, you have a basis. The basis is now the absolute. In other words, you understand?
Yeah.
The ocean. Let's look at it this way. The ocean. Now the waves are apparent. In the first one, there weren't many, there were very few waves, and you just saw the ocean. Here, the waves take over, and you just see the waves, but you don't see the ocean as a whole. Or, you have a pond, and there are no ripples. Then you throw in the stone, and you have ripples. So this is the realm of ripples, where you see the ripples. Your attention goes to the ripples.
So is that the everyday,
that's the everyday
consciousness that most people, 99.999% of humanity, walks around their whole life in?
Yeah.
Okay.
But it's also the realm of enlightenment. Because of the interconnectedness of both, because the ripples are just the activity of the pond. So it's not like it's separate, it's just that that's what's apparent, the apparent and the real. It's not really two different things. It's just one is the activity of the other. So, having attained the great perfect mirror wisdom, you now enter the rank of the real within the apparent. When you have accomplished your long practice of the jewel mirror samadhi, you directly realize the universal nature wisdom, and for the first time enter the state of the unobstructed interpenetration of noumena and phenomena. The ocean is noumena. The waves are phenomena. The pond is noumena. The ripples are phenomena. So, so then when we have the enlightenment, you realize the universal nature. Universal nature is sometimes called the nature of equality. This is like horizontal. You realize, in other words, your ego or seventh consciousness is dropped. And instead of seeing everything according to self-centeredness, self-centeredness is no longer the center of manas. Manas is no longer directing traffic. And you understand, you experience the equality. This is like what most people have an enlightenment experience, so-called. This is what they experience. They experience the equality of everything, of noumenon and phenomenon. We say oneness, right? That's the expression of oneness. When there's no longer self-centeredness, there's nothing to differentiate. But there's still something to differentiate. That's only one side. But this disciple must not be satisfied here, but must enter into the intimate acquaintance with the rank of the coming from within the real. That's the third circle. That's like a circle with a dot in the middle. Coming from within the real. After that, by depending upon the rank of the arrival at mutual integration, that person will completely prove the marvelous observing wisdom and the perfecting of action wisdom, and at last reach the rank of the unity attained, and after all, come back to sit among the total, the coals and ashes. So he's putting all the rest of them together in one paragraph. So the sixth consciousness becomes the marvelous observing wisdom, and the marvelous observing wisdom is vertical, hierarchical. You acknowledge the hierarchical nature of each individual thing. So you have equality this way and hierarchy this way. You need both. If everything is simply equal, that's not enough. That's great, but it's not enough. There also has to be hierarchy.
Everything hierarchy in what sense?
Hierarchy exists. It's not something you make up. It means the relationship of each thing to everything else.
I could see that as distinctness, but I don't get it in the sense of hierarchy as one thing above or superior to. Or
it's not a matter of superior or inferior. Simply a matter of where everything is. So you don't have to think of it that way if you don't want to. Sometimes, you know, we have a conditioned response to the word hierarchy. And our conditioned response to the word hierarchy means somebody's the boss and somebody else is below them and all that. That's just one use of the word hierarchy. In botany, a flower is created through its hierarchy. There's the stem and the leaves, and the stem and the leaves and the leaves of the flower and all these little parts, and they all are equal. Some are more equal than others. But that's called the hierarchy.
The hierarchy is like the relationship between the parts.
The hierarchy is
functional.
The functional relationship between the parts.
That's different from superior and inferior.
Yeah.
It's just relationship.
Sometimes it's called superior and inferior. But it's not. We're not trying to make a judgment on.
No, I'm really trying to know whether hierarchy is a satisfying word for us to use together.
Yeah, it may not be. It certainly exists within any organization. You cannot have. There's no such thing as an organization without hierarchy.
That's a power.
Cheese board.
You think that it's not hierarchical. That claims to be that, but if you know the people who have worked there, you know that it's not quite true.
When you describe, sorry, do you not want to be stopped in your?
Well, yeah, you know, we can use any other word you want. I don't want to discuss that because it takes too much time this particular context.
Okay.
Yeah, you mean, choose anything you can. You know, it just means the comparative nature of things, or how each thing exists as independently, except that nothing exists independently. So, but there is an independent nature of things, which is describes each. How each thing exists by itself, so as compared with everything else. It's got to be comparative. This is non-comparative, and this is comparative. If you only have one, then you leave out the other. And right there where they both meet is where you are. How everything exists. So, you may not be better than an ant, or greater than an ant, or as intelligent as an ant, or feel as much as an ant does, but you're big, and an ant is little. So, there's some comparative, you know, that's how we describe things. Also, when we see the nature of all the individual things, we see those things as empty. So to see in that way is to see the emptiness of all hierarchical entities.
Okay.
read it first.
Is this the same as the as what you're talking about in the Genjo Koan as the position of each dharma?
Yeah, each dharma exists in its own dharma position. Yes, which doesn't interfere with any other thing.
So, for me, this I'm experiencing this as a lot of constructs.
Yeah, it's a construct.
A lot of constructs. And so, to me, anything that's a construct is really not the experience of Zen. For me, that's my way of viewing Zen. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean this doesn't have value. I just can't make any sense of it, or make any, or follow it, or any make. So I'm wondering, since I don't understand it, even to use it. How do you use it? How does it function in the world in a useful way in the Zen world for you? Because this is just, for me, it's constructs, and I don't even understand really what they're pointing to. And maybe I'm not trying hard enough, but I don't, it's not, I'm not getting anything out of it.
Yeah, for me, it opens my mind. So I don't worry about what I get out of it. It doesn't bother. It's not. I'm not studying it to get something out of it.
Well, I'm not even getting the opening mind part. So I guess I'm just trying to understand what is it that you. How is it used for you in this?
I'm not using it. It's not used for me.
Because then you can look at a flower and have your mind open.
That's correct.
So, but
that's exactly what this is talking about.
But this is, I don't understand it.
I don't care. what am I supposed to say that you don't understand it?
Well, it's like, it seems like it's thinking. It's a lot of thinking. And I don't, and it, for me, then it's
you don't think.
Thinking is...
Do you think?
Of course. But
you think all the time.
But thinking, not all the time. But thank you for sharing.
When you see me, I see you as thinking all the time.
Okay.
So to complain about thinking, you
that's
know.
Not actually my experience, but thank you for knowing exactly what's going on inside of me. I don't have to, you know, I'm just saying that I'm not, I don't, I want to know how you use this as, like, what is it, what is the value
it.
To you?
I don't use it.
You don't use it.
No.
Why would you teach it if you don't need it?
I don't know. I'm just doing the best I can. To me, it's it's so beautiful. To me, it's just a beautiful flower, just a beautiful way to express what's going on in consciousness. That's all it is to me. It's just a beautiful way. I see its beauty, you know. That's what it is to me. I don't know if it helps me or helps you. Or to me, it's just a beautiful way to express what I feel goes on inside of me. When we talk about ego and all these things, well, what are we talking about? How do you where do you locate that?
Ego doesn't really exist, it's a construct.
Yeah, so how do you describe your constructs? Have you let go of all your constructs?
Well, I don't know if I want to add another one, but has anyone let go of all your constructs?
I don't mind it being construct. That doesn't bother me. We're always thinking in terms of constructs. Why should I be bothered that it's a construct? Of course it's a construct. It's a model. That's exactly what it is. It's a model of consciousness. It's a model of how consciousness works.
But don't somehow you take it though beyond just a construct? It's not just a construct.
The mirror is a construct. It is a construct which is a model of consciousness, of the way consciousness works.
Would you say though, for me, it would be that there's something more than just, oh, this is a thought, this is a wonderful thought or a very articulate thought, but that this thought it actually changes your way of seeing to a certain extent.
It does help me think about how consciousness works.
But only think about it, not...
Well, what do you mean only think about it? I didn't say only think about it. I just said it helps me to think about how consciousness works. I think that's the value of it.
Okay.
If you want to talk about a value.
Is the set of five ranks or these kinds of different concepts of consciousness you've been playing with, is it similar to like the Oxfording pictures?
Well, the Oxfording pictures are, the five ranks. Five ranks and the ten Oxfording pictures. And as I explained before, at the time of Tozan, Isan and other teachers were using circles to help them in teaching.
So it's interesting to hear and feel the whatever Denise is trying to say, but. And then I liked your answer. I mean, I respected her kind of discontent. And then I liked your answer when you said, at first you were a little bit like, well, I don't care. That didn't seem so right on. But then when you said, I like it because it's beautiful.
Yeah.
It's like a flower. It seems like the things that help us and open us are things that can strike us in a way that's more like our beauty-centered.
Yeah.
The terminology in what you're talking about seems so abstract. Like the Oxfording pictures might be able to strike us in a more aesthetic way, in a way that kind of slips past our cognitive, stuff. I think there's just a little more difficulty for us with these very abstract sounding concepts, even though they're actually referring to something alive, right?
Yeah. Well, that's why I chose Hakuin, because Hakuin is the least abstract. But as we go along, I need to explain what he's talking about. Otherwise, you don't get it. So every time he says something, I want to make that clear what he's talking about. And in order to do that, I have to go through, But to me, the model of eight consciousnesses is just crystal clear. It's just so obvious and logical. It's not abstract to me.
Well, the eight consciousnesses, that's not in question. What's for me, I don't understand, those five ranks. I haven't followed it at all.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I'm not that stupid a person. I'm pretty, a little bit smart, a little bit, and I can understand lots of spiritual material, and I haven't been able to track it, and it doesn't make any sense to me.
But here's what I get from you, okay?
Yeah.
Is that you always complain. You're always complaining. Every time I hear you say something, it's always a complaint. I've never heard you say anything that was not a complaint.
Okay, I'm going to end the complaint, dear sir. I'm so sorry. I need to be able to ask a question. It's like, I don't ask that many questions. But if you don't want me here, I'm happy to go. That's all right. I'm happy to go. I don't want to bother you with my questions.
Well, I didn't say I didn't want you here.
Well, then you can't say
that. I just said you always complain. Everything you say is a complaint. So that's,
you always say that I'm complaining. Maybe it's just you saying that I'm complaining. Another teacher wouldn't have to see it as a complaint. But I don't really like that kind of response.
All right. I haven't figured out how to respond to you.
Well, it's just that I don't understand this, and I'm not learning something from it, and I'm trying to ask you, okay, how can I get something out of this? Or what am I... I'm here for not just no reason. I came here tonight. I could be doing something else.
Yeah.
You know, we all... And I'm not here, like, I'm here trying to get... And if you want, I'll just be quiet, and I don't have to tell you. I'm not understanding it. And I'm a long-term Zen student, and it doesn't make any sense to me. I practiced in koan practice for 20 years, and this makes no sense to me.
Just listening to it over and over again is what I have hope will help me to understand it. I also don't understand it, but that doesn't bother me very much. I understand it a little bit sometimes, I think. And I think that hearing it over and over again is the best way.
I understand that this is about some form of integration that you're talking about, and that's it. And I think that sometimes to take Zen into an area of, like, where you're creating more constructs is just not what Zen is about.
Yeah, well, you know, just accept it. No problem. You don't have to understand it. You really don't. All you have to do is just sit out there. No words, no explanations, no problems like that. Really, truly. What I'm doing is just trying to expose something, you know, like the history. I didn't make this up. This is like, you know, considered, it's been considered by all of our predecessors and found to be something that is helpful for people.
Okay, first of all, it's not all of our predecessors, but it's some.
Yeah, some of our predecessors. Mm-hmm.
And I guess the point I'm trying to make is, to me, Zen is very clear and direct, and it's not about making more constructs. And that's all. That's why I have an issue with that.
But Denise, I think that these five ranks are describing experience. They're not just a thought or a picture, but they're a description.
No, I understand they're trying to.
They're a description of people's experience.
I understand they're trying to explain different types of manifestation of practice. I understand that.
Yeah.
And, you know, I really echo, at least for me as a newer person, what Paul's saying is I have such a desire for my intellectual faculties to gain mastery. I mean, that's so reinforced, you know, culturally. And what I find with this is I actually like it more than the Oxford pictures. Those bother me. I'm an aversion to them. I don't get it. But it's like I let it wash over me and I like loosen myself up that I don't have to figure it out. And there is more repetition than an intellectually, you know, kind of focus on going to get it. And I feel like there's something about Zen that is about unraveling something that I don't get at all. That feels very Zen to me that I feel in this. But I feel what you're talking about. I've had those feelings. But what I found is I just kind of let it wash over. And there are moments that I feel something that resonates in the moment, but I'm thinking, what the heck, I don't get it, but I just let it wash over.
So, Shiroshi, how much of this chart would the ancient masters from Sekido on use in the secret room with their best students?
Well, I think that often a teacher will say, when the student comes in and you show them something, they recognize it right away. and then you can work with that student.
But how much? I mean, so what subject would they start with?
Anything.
Okay.
Nothing special.
Sorry.
Anything. But it like there are students and teachers who have affinity. And when there's that affinity, then you can develop something, work with something. So that would be the often, you know, in the past, historically, the teacher would say to the student, "You can enter my room anytime," because there's an affinity. There are certain documents and things in the past that were considered something for esoteric, maybe, right? So the student would understand that, but then teacher could help develop their understanding because of the affinity. If there's no affinity, you can't do anything. So that's the way it.
So it doesn't make any difference what it is, just so long as they're on the same right. Wavelength.
So that's right.
Okay.
Yeah. And this is like, you know, ancient Buddhism, right? It's not even Zen. It's just like this comes from Vasubandhu. So we're actually, in a way, we're studying Vasubandhu's teaching. And Vasubandhu is considered one of the chief patriarchs of our any Zen lineage. So what is Vasubandhu's teaching? That's what I'm presenting through Tozan. I'm presenting Vasubandhu's teaching, Tozan's teaching, Sekito's teaching, Ungan's teaching. It's all there. That's what I'm presenting to you. You may be interested in it. You may not. Some people doesn't interest at all, you know. Like Tozan and Sozan. Sozan and Tozan had this kind of understanding with each other, and so they both developed this five ranks. Ungo Doyo, who continued Tozan's line, wasn't interested in it at all. And we don't use Tozan's name in the lineage, we use Ungo's name in the lineage. So if this interests you, fine. If it doesn't interest you, you know, fine. It's not necessary. You're welcome. Our mind stopped for a moment.
Just what you were saying reminded me of one of the favorite things that I ever heard when I heard a talk by the Dalai Lama. And he gave this speech, and it was in the Greek Theater here in Berkeley, and all these thousands of people hanging on his every word. And then at the end of it, he said in that little up and down voice of his, he said, "If I've said anything that you like and you can use, please use it. And if not, please forget about it."
Yeah.
It was so kind of sweet and gracious, and acknowledged that we might not find what he said useful, and that was really okay.
Yeah. Exactly. Right. So that's what I'm doing. I'm just presenting their teachings, which I happen to really enjoy.
Yeah.
I find that they're really very deep and enjoyable and revealing. So, but, you know, for some people it doesn't make sense, you know. And Zen is just directly entering the realm of enlightenment, you know. You don't need it. But
it helps to hear what's important about it to you so that we can, you know, so that maybe I would love to get something out of it.
Yeah, well, everything I say is really interesting to me, mm-hmm. you know. Like, all of his references are interesting to me. Because I've studied, I think I've studied quite a bit of stuff about Zen and Buddhism, and when he says something, it reflects all those things, you know, that just pop, 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 fall into place. And that's interesting, you know, it's exciting that he's connecting with all these other teachers in the past. Talking about the sixth ancestors, you know, he's quoting all these people, not saying it, all that. And to recognize that, I think, is, and to know where he's coming from, very interesting. And so we're studying Hakuin, who would be the first to say, you don't need it. But he says, you do need it. The Hakuin would be the first to say, just directly enter. He would be the first to say, Zen is just directly entering, of course. But here he's talking about this. So why is he doing that? Anyway, I just do it for my enjoyment, and I hope that you enjoy it. But I find it exciting. Actually,
Huffman's humor is really well set forth in that little book that Kaz did called Penetrating Laughter.
Yeah.
So there's one self-portrait that he did, and it had a caption that said something like, "One more time, this stinking old monk is filling up a piece of paper. Damn!"
Okay, well, I hope you come back.
There's just one more class?
Well, there's one more class this month.
Oh. And then next month?
No, then we have to figure out what to do next.
Oh.
Isn't it usually the... Did we just figure it out month by month, or is it the last
month?
No,
we do a six-month set. This is the fifth. We do one more, and then we figure out what to do next.
Okay.
I'd like to vote for another 6 months.
On this? The start of the
weekend.
Yeah.
Well, whatever. I mean, I feel that there's a lot that we haven't gone to. Plus, it's obvious that we could go over it because we've forgotten.
That's right. Otherwise, you know, when you get it, then you can just start discussing it. But I was also thinking, since it's a month at a time in distance, that you lose the continuity, and to just do one session is just one subject for one time.
Right.
And then one subject for one time. So the discussion or whatever, you know, it could even be a test that you bring up or whatever.